Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our host today is AAPC's Vice President, Kyle Roberts, CEO of Ad Impact and Smart Media Group. Kyle is one of the top Republican media strategists in the nation with over 20 years of experience in political media buying. He will be leading the discussion with Sarah Fagan, CEO of Tunnel Data and Deep Root Analytics and former White House political director. Sarah is a renowned technology and data entrepreneur and longtime board member at the AAPC. Together, they will examine how technological advancements are reshaping the political consulting industry. Kyle, take it away.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, everyone from a chilly Washington, D.C. right now. Again, my name's Kyle Roberts. I'm president CEO of Ad Impact and a company called Smart Media Group. And I'm your host this morning, and I'm very happy to introduce our guest, who I would say is both a doer and a builder in American politics. And when I say doer, I mean she started out pretty much at the bottom in politics and earned the top job as political director in the White House. So pretty much ran the gamut on the political side as an operative. And then once she left as an operative in politics, she went on to become an entrepreneur. And that's the builder piece. Built great companies, leads great companies. At least two to three come to mind to me. And I'm going to ask her about that in a minute. But, you know, it's great that we have people who are just building really cool stuff in American politics because it's much needed. Campaigns are so fierce. They're so competitive. And you need companies that are building great tools to give campaigns the edge. And so I just want to give a warm hello to Sarah Fagan, who is the president and CEO of Deep Root Analytics / Tunnel. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good. Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. As I just said in my intro there, we'll get into like innovations in data and politics. It's very exciting. Our business is very exciting right now. There's a lot going on. First, though, can you talk about your journey as a political operative and then your journey? Why did you decide to become an entrepreneur? You know, it's not an easy route, right? A lot of challenges. But could you just give the audience just a little background just on you in particular as an operative and an entrepreneur?
Sure. You know, it's an interesting story. And it's because in some ways, I'm an accidental entrepreneur. It wasn't really my plan when I was leaving the White House. But, you know, I just loved politics growing up as a kid. Being in Iowa, I had a front row seat to presidential campaigns. My father was a Republican activist at the county level in Dubuque, Iowa. He was a former legislator, and he was friends with Chuck Grassley. And so in 1980, when I was like 5 or 6 years old, he was the county chairman. And that's really how it started. And then, of course, Ronald Reagan was running. So I was following, you know, sort of him around for years, and then just got very active as a young person in college Republicans. I was a page in the Iowa legislature. And I started doing campaigns in college, first Phil Gramm for president, which is really where I got the bug. And after college, but I liked the data side always. And I was really interested in polling, got to work for a local pollster named Bob House in Iowa in college after the Gramm campaign. And then I moved out to the Terrence Group and spent a couple years there where I really learned a great deal under Ed Goes, Brian Tringali, some of the very experienced, well-known pollsters in the business. But I wanted to do presidential campaigns, like, and I wanted to work for George W. Bush. So I sort of stalked Karl Rove is like really what I did. And I had all these Iowans like emailing him and telling him to hire me. And so ultimately that came to pass. And I was a field operative, a coalitions director. To your point, I started out as a junior staffer and worked my way into the White House. And then ultimately, but it was really the data side that got, I would say, that gave me the ability to do well fast. Having that kind of, and I say this to young people all the time, like get a craft in the business. And whether it's media or press or polling, like learn something specific. And, you know, during the reelect, you know, then I get to play a really big role in the polling and media buying operation, and ultimately micro-targeting in part landed on my desk. And that's kind of how this all started.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. You asked me about the entrepreneurial journey. So I was in the White House. I was political director in the second term, and I was planning to go like take a big corporate job. And I was close to going to work at Lehman Brothers, of all places, in 2007. And then Democrats had taken control of the Congress in 07 after the 06 elections, and they just started investigating everything. And I was the White House political director. So I got investigated on a, I did, the White House got investigated, and I got called to testify on something, of course, that I didn't really have anything to do with, but nonetheless, that's what happens in politics. It can be a tough business. But Lehman Brothers was basically like, yeah, I'm not really sure. Like, call us in a few months when this gets behind you. Like, we're super interested. And at that point, I was kind of like, well, I got to go to work. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I ended up joining a media firm out of the gate, which really wasn't the right fit for me. But once I had established that I could get clients, which is always the fear, I think, for people, is will anyone hire me?
You know, totally right. Totally.
You know, and you sort of think that's too much risk and like, how will I pay my bills? But I figured quickly that, you know, you work hard, you do a good job. Like people have needs and they will hire you. And at that point, that's really what launched the entrepreneurial journey. That once I figured out that I could do that and survive, going to work for anyone else didn't seem like it was the right fit for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. The client piece, you're always worried that you won't find someone, right, who's going to hire you, and you're not going to have that initial base of revenue, of income. And what I tell people too, is just like you were saying, like have a craft. I do think that's really important. You should be specialized. Mm-hmm. That's a certain vulnerability, but you have to really know something very well. But, you know, what I realized too over time was your job becomes just getting those clients. Like, it's not, you stop thinking about all the other stuff and it's like, well, that's just my job now. And if I'm going to do my job well, I'm going to get these clients. And then things start to take on a life of their own. Hopefully, if you get clients, right, it just kind of snowballs, you know? But people have that fear of like, well, can I do it? Can I not do it? Can I run the whole thing? It's like, it really just becomes a specific job. You do it well. And, you know, you need a broad range of expertise, of course. I mean, running businesses is also something that's not difficult. I mean, it's something that is difficult, I should say, right? That was a whole lesson, I'm sure, for you as well, wasn't it?
Well, it yes. And, you know, so I've Tunnel is really the second like big technology company that I've been a part of. I was a partner at DDC, which I was not the founder of, but spent many years there. And a great firm, advocacy firm downtown. And we were, the leadership team was successful in exiting that company to Omnicom, of which I was a part of. So I learned a lot about the exit process there. But, and DDC is a bit of a hybrid because they did have a PAC technology product that had a different multiple on it than what is typically a services firm. And so I think most firms are services firms. And they are not that complicated to run. They're hard to run. You got to get clients. You got to hire talent. It's not, none of it is easy. But running a technology company is a lot harder. Like the accounting of it, you're dealing with lots of different payments, different valuations on different products. So that definitely has forced me, and I think anyone who does it, to really stretch, but in a good way, because, you know, things worth doing are often really hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree. And yes, technology companies, much different from service companies, they are more complex. I totally agree with that. And learning that is not easy. You know, you do it sometimes by mistakes. And they call that experience.
When I was leaving the White House, I kind of thought, well, I got to, you know, I was thinking about going to Wall Street. I was thinking about getting an MBA because I started politics so early. I didn't go to graduate school. And I kind of felt like that's something I really needed to do. And I called Phil Graham, who, you know, was a mentor of mine. I had worked for him, and he was at UBS. So I thought, also a good job prospect potentially. I was thinking of banking. And he just like in that very thick Georgian Texan accent, he basically was like, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. It was just so direct. He's like, your Rolodex is worth $1 million. Why would you go to business school? Just go start a business and figure it out. And he was exactly right. Like, that was great. Some of the best advice I ever got.
Yeah. That's great. That's a great story. That's a great story. All right, let's talk about some tech and innovation. Of course, there's a lot going on in the space. Let's just start with, well, another interesting question. I mean, here you start. You leave the White House when in 2007, 2008?
Mid-2007. Mm-hmm.
Think about the journey in media, right? From 2007 up until 2024. How much has changed in our space? I mean, the emergence of CTV, ACR data, set-top box data, you know, just the challenges there alone, right? And the fragmentation of audience, all that stuff. It's funny, how do you see that all like evolving? And, you know, if you think about back then what you were doing and what was important, and think about today what you're doing and what's important.
Yeah, I think it just adds more layers. So if like you think back to, you know, micro-targeting, which, you know, certainly was the biggest innovation.
Yeah.
I mean, sort of digital and social, which happened by major technology companies, not by political operatives, was a huge innovation in politics that the Obama team really like took advantage of for the first time in 2008. But so like in 2000, 2004, when I was doing campaigns, like micro-targeting was the biggest innovation because it fundamentally changed the way the parties did direct contact. You know, we did precinct targeting largely for mail and phone purposes off basically precinct percentages. And Alex Gage and Brent Seaborn, my partner now, and others like developed this new process. And so, but it was fairly static. Like you would go do it, you would do it once, you'd come up with a bunch of segments, you'd mail and phone them. Like it wasn't useful. It wasn't available to use in digital. Digital was also just very nascent at the time. And so you were just lucky to get anything there. I did see that in 2004. Like I remember thinking we were trying to do these video ads with Mrs. Bush. We spent a bunch of budget on creative. They were beautiful. And it was just really hard to execute it because the technology just wasn't advanced. And I did think at some point micro-targeting and digital is going to collide. And that was really the genesis for Resonate, which is a company I founded and sold a few years ago. And then the TV piece became more real. And the Obama, you know, it's oftentimes in politics at the presidential level, one party sort of leapfrogs, like one party has an innovation, the next year, the next party has a different, more advanced innovation. And we've seen that volley a bunch over the years. The Obama team had really developed TV targeting before Republicans. And, you know, they were doing multiple ads in a market kind of tailored toward different audiences. And so we were behind. And in the Romney campaign, and I guess it was 12, my partners and I basically built sort of a prototype of what was Deep Root Analytics to help them better target advertising. And so that was an innovation there. And now as we evolve, we get into the CTV, which is really just back to doing more dynamic micro-targeting and having the ability to port data through digital channels in a privacy compliant way. I think probably what's next is like, and something we've been working on and certainly have launched a reach and frequency product, but there's room to grow there in terms of sophistication, is being able to pull all that digital data back. And that's what's like, that's not really easy to do today, but in time we will get there. And I think that will be kind of the next big thing in politics.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really the huge innovation that's we're sort of at the dawn of right now is connecting these dots, right? But almost having an outcome-based campaign happening in real time. We're almost there.
Yeah, like corporate marketers have been doing this in the social channel space. Yeah. You know, if you're big enough and you can get the attention of the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, like you can get probably better data back. And they're spending a ton on social, which is, you know, when you look at sort of the marketing spend overall as an advertising industry, like it is amazing what a large piece of social is compared to even these other channels. But CTV in politics is really important because of the emotional connection, the ability to get a 30 or 60 second spot where you can actually make a connection with the voter. Very hard to do that in social, almost impossible in sort of traditional digital. You can get a message across, you can get a quick snippet, you can motivate your supporters. There's a lot of value in those ads, but it's not the same. It's not the same.
Yep. And to go a little deeper on that, so in a little more specific, you know, Tunnel was the data provider for the McCormick for Senate campaign in Pennsylvania. You know, that was, you know, one of the four Senate races in the swing states. You know, we got close in Michigan, we got close in Wisconsin, you know, close in Nevada, you know, but we won in Pennsylvania, and Tunnel was really at the center of all that. Can you just talk, like you mentioned the reach and frequency tool. And again, we're getting into a lot of specifics here, but it's extremely powerful. It's extremely hard to do in real time, you know, and as a traditional media buyer, you know, I don't know if you know this, but reach and frequency was only something you could do post-campaign. And like a few months after the campaign ended, you'd go back, you'd take everything, all the GRPs that you ran, you'd try to match it up with the diaries, and you'd try to come out with, oh, okay, here's what we think we did. It's only post-campaign you could do it. Now, because of the so much real-time data that's available, this is something that can happen in campaign. It's a huge innovation. You just want to talk about that for a minute and how you got there?
Yes. You know, it's really a sort of desire to do attribution, which I think ultimately is, like I said, so it's sort of been happening at the corporate level for a long time, at least on some digital channels, including social. In politics, you know, linear is still a really large piece of the effort to communicate with voters. And so because we're pulling in set-top box data and matching it to the audiences, and we're pulling in the ad occurrence data, which of course we get from Ad Impact, we're able to use those timestamps to get a sense of who was watching at the time in which the ad ran. So that all kind of works in concert to allow us to understand that. And so that we have solved for linear, and that is what the McCormick team, especially the Super PAC, really very effectively use that data. I think among the most, so that gives you a good sense of what's being sort of saturated. I think the next level of it is to bring in CTV data, which is sort of admittedly harder because it's an individual, you know, linear TV is still a one to many.
Yeah.
Pull in the entire sort of footprint and figure out who is likely to have been watching it. CTV, you've got to basically get the buy, almost impossible to get the opponent's buy. I mean, we're sort of constantly trying to think through how to solve for this and potentially through a panel. There's other things, but kind of ultimately, at least for candidates, you can pull it in. And that will be a really significant advancement. And I think what we see from that data, which is applicable across politics, irrespective of party, and frankly, true of, you know, any kind of advocacy effort, any kind of brand campaign as well, is a large piece of any audience is not being exposed very much to the advertising, particularly on linear. And so when linear is a part of your plan, you know, what we increasingly look and recommend is that you break kind of your audience into segments. You know, it's like the segment of the segment, because there's certain people you can saturate quickly. Like the old way that we bought TV 20 years ago, which is you throw up an ad, you run 800 or 1,000 points, you've saturated it, you move the ad. That will work for maybe 20 to 30% of your audience. And that's an okay strategy. There's another group where you really need a mix of linear and CTV to reach saturation. But you got to let that linear burn in a lot longer. And then there's just another group that's just really difficult to reach. And you got to think about other tactics to reach them. And that's, you know, a campaign that's like running for 6 weeks or something. Because it's not that you can't reach them, but you're just not going to reach them fast. And you've got to layer in social, you got to layer in mail and phones, you know, and campaigns do these things anyway. But my sense in watching politics is that people are, campaigns of both parties are now using audiences more than ever, which is great. They're now spending more in CTV, which is important. But they're sort of still treating every audience on a holistic level and not sort of considering that people in those audiences are consuming media very differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Segmenting those audiences based upon consumption.
Yeah.
You also built Tunnel last year, early last year, released their audience platform, which, I mean, for the audience, if I describe it properly, right, you just go in, you can build out your segments right within your platform. You can download the segment and then you can send it to a DSP and you can execute on it. I mean, it's a pretty seamless operation interface. I'm sure there's a lot of data behind that. And I'm sure it took a lot of time to figure that out. And I'm just curious, like, what was that like building that whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have a really great team of technologists and product people. And that's like one of the things as you build a business, you realize like, you know, like you got to know what you know and you got to know what you don't know. And so we have a team and we give them a lot of agency to go study the market and build things. But, you know, I think kind of ultimately it's getting it all together. And one of the benefits that I think we've had is because of, you know, one point Deeproot and Target Point merged. And so the library that Michael Myers, Brent Seaborn, Alicia Downs, and others like had built for a 20 plus year period, like that's really like that was incredibly valuable because you have so much history and it very, and particularly like around party and some of the things that are very determinative in terms of how people view the world and where they align on issues, is that the data's gotten, you know, we have so much data on individuals. But then we marry that with commercial data, we marry that with the library, and then we continuously ask surveys. So one of the things we've invested in behind the scenes to make that all happen is just a very robust survey research infrastructure that is fairly automated at this point, so that you're kind of quickly being able to adjust and update those audiences. We have a ton coming out. Like we've been busy working. So we're going to actually completely redo that platform in terms of at least the visual and the user experience. And that should be coming out in the next few months, which we're really excited about. And we're adding a lot of consumer insights. So one of the things we hear from the market, this is partly driven by corporate and brand folks, but it will impact the political clients as well, is that they just want more information about these audiences. And then ultimately to be able to adjust the audiences so that if you decide, like, look, there's always art and science to doing this the right way. And, you know, we're the science part of it. But, you know, you still need strategists who have a sense of where they're going, a candidate. You know, and you might decide that you really just want a more female audience, even if the data says this is the audience, but you're making the judgment that it should be more female, should be older, it should be have more minority representation, whatever it may be, then giving our clients the ability to make those adjustments. Yeah. And then have it recalibrate so you understand what it looks like and then push it and just push it on demand.
Yeah, you touched on it. One key part of these audiences is really refresh. And right, if you're surveying a lot in market and you have automated survey, you can refresh audiences and that improves targeting. Mm-hmm. And that improves also the value of those audiences.
That's right.
More connected to outcome.
Yep.
You know, we have, you know, in our industry, we have a lot of general consultants that are members of the AAPC, a lot of media companies, a lot of creative companies. You know, what would you say, like, if you had to say, okay, every campaign should be using data and here are two or three best practices, especially, you know, data is so complex. It's so hard sometimes for people to really understand, what do I do with all of these things? How do they actually really benefit me? You know, we see it in the business, right? There's a lot of young campaign managers that don't really understand all this stuff. You know, they're basically handed keys to a Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just, you know, they don't understand the power of these things. And so if you can talk to that for just a minute and say, look, here are three basic things you should think about, two or three basic things you should think about when you're putting your campaign together about how to effectively use data or what to do before you execute on data, what would you say?
Well, so I think, like, I say this all the time when I talk to clients, like, no amount of data is going to solve like a fundamental problem in your campaign. So we can do everything right. We can ask the questions perfectly. We can build you the best segments that are refreshed biweekly or monthly or whatever your cadence is. Like, if you sort of fundamentally don't know why you're running for office, don't know what your message is to your public affairs community, don't have a good sense of that, like, the data is not going to solve it. So, like, I think still at a fundamental level, like, a theory of the case, a strong message, and having done that legwork then allows the data to become very powerful. I think sometimes people, you know, they do one of two things. They either sort of, they get really kind of caught up in the messaging part of it and they decide the rest of it is all noise and they don't need it. And so they underinvest in infrastructure because they think their message will just carry the day. And sometimes that happens, but oftentimes in close races, like, you really regret those decisions. And then the alternative is they don't have a good message, they don't have a good infrastructure, and they believe that they invest in data that'll just solve the problem for them. And, like, you know, I mean, voters are sophisticated, and we can get you in front of the right voters, but if you don't connect with them, ultimately we can't solve that problem. I think best practices when using data is to, and I think people have gotten better at this, but you sort of still sometimes see it as, these states have become more complicated, and you really have to understand the rules of the election and the timing of the election. And I think people still spend budget way too late in some cases, and where, you know, you might have 20 or 30% of the electorate having already voted before you really, I think that frankly was probably an issue in Nevada this last time, right? Is that, you know, there are budget issues and people are making decisions about, you know, other states, but, like, ultimately it's such a heavy early vote state that, like, a bunch of things had happened before a lot of money was spent. And so I think that that's one of the most important things is, like, really understanding it. And then we say, it's easy for us to say because we don't have to raise the money, but I think spending money late and adjusting. People change. Audiences change. Understanding who's voted, removing them. I think that is another thing where you're, you know, getting a good baseline in the spring and the summer, depending on the cycle, is good. But then, like, September, October, like, be refreshing your data. Because in these close races, it really matters. So that, I think that's a good practice. And then also hire somebody. Like, at the end of the day, have a data director, and most campaigns do this, certainly at the statewide level, but have a really good data director and have him or her at the table.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I'm just curious, I don't know this, but does Tuttle have like a managed service where campaigns will call directly or no?
Yes. I mean, we always have an account management team. We've done embeds in before. I mean, this is Deeproot, the Deeproot side of the house.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, Tuttle serves the brand, corporate affairs and public affairs markets. We're less likely to get asked. Most of the folks have somebody that leads this internally. And so then we just, you know, we always assign an account manager, customer success person, you know, to make sure that we're able to answer questions and, you know, make adjustments should people need it. But we haven't really embedded too many places.
It is a great point. Like, people just think data is going to solve the problems, but it's really not true. It's a vehicle to get you to victory, but it's not the winning solution. You have to know your why. You do. Campaigns fundamentally do need to know that. And early voting, you're right, is key because, I mean, I can remember there were some states where we didn't go in because, like, 60, 70% of the electorates already voted. Like, forget it. It's over. And then updating those audiences, people do forget that. People vote. They come out of the universe. Refresh your universes. Make sure you're only hitting the people that didn't vote. It's a great, great piece of advice. And then having a data person in-house is a great idea because, again, if you have a why and you have a good message, data is really now going to help you drive an outcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think like the Obama campaign, if I'm trying to remember back in 08, you know, in some of these key markets, they were running 3 or 4 ads and they were taking different time slots based on the audiences they were trying to reach. And we see a little of that, but it's much less than you would think. Like people, like I said, they tend to sort of treat, they're spending money on audiences. That's good. They're narrowing a universe of swing voters or high turnout Republicans, depending on the objective. But they're still largely running one ad at a time and maybe two ads at a time. But there's a lot, you know, I think, like, frankly, the media buying space, it's gotten more competitive, like most things in politics. It's going to require more people to do it effectively over time because, you know, you're going to need to be treating these audience segments separately. You're going to need a linear portion. You're going to need a CTV linear portion. And you're going to have a portion that's just like hard to reach on video. And so you got to find them another way. And that's going to require the media and team as well as like the direct mail and social team to work a lot more together. And like, it wouldn't surprise me if over time, like, I'm not saying this just because you're the host, like media firms are going to probably charge more because it's going to actually require a lot more people to do this effectively.
Yeah, to do it well. It is hard. It is hard. Your point about having a data director in-house at a campaign can help facilitate between mail and phones and TV, because now that can happen, as you know, more than ever, right? Someone can go into your interface and pick a universe. You can mail to it. You can call it and you can target it online.
That was really one of the thesis around building the company the way we wanted is that, and this sort of came out of the public affairs space when I ran advocacy campaigns. It's like you'd get in a room, some company or set of companies would be spending a lot of money on an advocacy effort. There'd be 4 or 5 teams around the table, all doing good work, all doing different things. And someone say, well, we need to target elites. And everyone go back and build their own audience. And I thought, well, that's bonkers. No one's talking to the same people. And, you know, we saw that need in the market, but it's also just true, you know, in campaigns is like having a unified spine, data spine will help ensure that the right people get communicated with.
When you look into the future, do you think like what I see is, you know, people always ask about, oh, what's the next big thing? Everything. I feel like in our business, some things do show up, new trend, like hybrid ads is kind of new and they're kind of getting bigger now. But I feel like on the data side, we just continue to improve. We continue to hone it. And I feel like it incrementally evolves. It doesn't like, it's not like overnight, there's just a huge change and everything's evolved into a whole different piece. When you look into the future though, like when you look at like artificial intelligence, machine learning, LLMs, all this stuff, I'm sure you're thinking about that. I'm sure you're trying to incorporate it into your data sets. How do you feel like that's going to change things?
So it's interesting. I was actually reading something this morning about all this. I mean, we always joke, like we were AI for 20 years. We've been an AI company for 20 years. Like we've been using machine learning models, you know.
Yeah, same here.
They've gotten bigger and more sophisticated. But there's kind of, you know, machine learning algorithms. And then there's the generative piece of it, which is, you know, with sort of the ChatGPTs and Gemini and some of these other tools that are in the market now. I think the first place we're seeing it is in creative. And I think there's an opportunity to, you know, to do much more personalization. You know, we have somebody, we had a guy on our team kind of playing around with a model with our audience set, you know, was able basically to pull in anything on any image on the internet and create an audience to target it. So like there's a coat at Nordstrom and you could pull it in and based on the description of the coat and the price point, you know, you could have a completely computer generated audience to go target that. Just as that's like something that's coming, I think. Whereas you in the future, you'll sort of see we upload the ad and based on the language, the candidate, the party, the imagery, you could build an audience automatic. Now, campaigns have to decide if they want to turn that much power over to technology. But I think that's the kind of stuff that where we're headed. I mean, the other big innovation that will start to happen, I think, across the board in the market research space is in polling. And I think AI will dramatically improve polling. I mean, right now, the response rate, something we struggle with, every pollster struggles with, it's just, you know, being able to get people, you know, certainly online and text to web and some of these other modes have improved that, but it's just still really hard. I think you'll see synthetic agents taking polls, and it'll take a data set like Tunnel or something that's very robust that has so much data attached to it, where you'll be able to, with great accuracy, take a poll against the data. I mean, we didn't release it, and frankly, we should have, but we just took our interviews. We built out a model on the Electoral College, one of our technologists. It took all the interviews that we had, and in the micro-targeting space, you know, basically most of this stuff stops around, you know, October 10th at the latest. So we didn't even have 3 weeks of data right before the election. And we called every state but one.
Wow.
Just based on the data, not like, hey, this is what I think.
Yeah.
And so I looked at that and said, had we had 3 more weeks of data, we would have nailed the Electoral College. And that was just based on polling. And that was based on, you know, just the data set and the robustness of the data.
Yeah, the frequency and the size of the survey itself. And then when you say every state, did you mean 50 states or the swing states?
Yeah, all 50. Well, I mean, some of them are easy, like the Alabamas of the world.
Yes, yeah.
I think the only one we were off on was Michigan.
Yeah, wow, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. So final question, what's next for you guys? What are you going to be working on in 2025? What should people be looking for in 2026?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So we're continuing to evolve reach and frequency. We believe that is an important product, not only in the political space, but actually in the corporate space. You know, we see a lot of demand there for people, not only just in brand space, but also just sort of general market, kind of looking to understand who's been exposed to their advertising. And then, of course, bring CTV data into that. And we've been working with a couple of the largest platforms to be able to pull their data back in. So that will get us a long way to that point. So that's one big thing we're focused on. And then the second thing is doing campaign effectiveness, where we are launching a survey, essentially in an automated fashion. You're able to then run your campaign against that audience across whatever medium you want, but then be able to measure against it so that we know who was the exposed audience. We built the audience for the client, and then to re-survey it and figure out what movement we've had against the control, the group that wasn't exposed. So that plus a whole lot of user improvements, just in terms of making sure there's more connectivity between the platform, that you've built an audience and you want linear ratings, you just pop it over and get them, as opposed to having to kind of go back out, save your audience, you know, move it. So we've got a lot of that coming, just really to improve the experience. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, really, that's, again, almost an outcome-based, attribution-based mm-hmm. measurement system for political campaigns, which we don't really have yet, but we're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there. And we have a lot of great partners, a lot of data providers. You guys are one of them. We use a lot of commercial available data. We use a lot of polling data that we've been building. And, you know, we're now doing almost 10,000-12,000 surveys a month plus, you know, so we're just continuing to build that data moat. So
very cool. Well, thank you for your time, Sarah. This has really been informative and very helpful.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. Good walk down memory lane.
Yes, yes.
That was our chat with Kyle Roberts and Sarah Fagan. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media @TheAAPC. Thanks for listening.